Hello, and welcome to the Yes Indeed podcast, created by Mark Shepherd and run by me, Thomas Manuel. Sorry, I just dropped something. Just give me a second. Oh, what is this? Oh, it's the link to my Patreon at patreon.com/indierpg. I'm trying to raise some money so that I can hire an editor to edit these podcasts for me. So if you can support me at all financially, I would really appreciate it. If you can't, that's absolutely not a problem. I'm just glad you're here. I'm just glad you're listening. If you are a patron already, I double, triple appreciate you for being here. So with that casual, and I think we can all agree, extremely subtle plug for my Patreon, all we have to do is run tape. And I'm here with Lowell Francis. Lowell is the person behind the Emmy Award-winning RPG blog, Age of Ravens, which you can find at ageofravensgames.com now. It's been going on for more than 10 years. I think of it as a bit of an institution in the RPG blogging space. He's the co-designer of the fantastic Hearts of Wulin, a PBTA game of Wuxia melodrama. He is also the Gauntlet Gaming Community Manager and co-host of the Gauntlet Podcast. So Lowell has been doing this podcasting thing a lot longer than I have. And maybe you'll be able to tell by the end of this episode. And also, as I was telling Lowell just before recording, I have done some research. So I'm also able to add three interesting details. Lowell is a comics author. He met his wife playing Magic the Gathering. And he was also knocked over by the fifth Doctor Who at a signing event. So this is the tidbits you can't get anywhere else, folks.
I love it. That's great. I appreciate that you know that last detail. That's a great one. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. So what's the story there? Why did you get knocked over by a supernatural being?
It would have been early 80s, and my dad was teaching for his university in the summer in London. And I got dragged along as an unappreciative kid, and I got dragged to all kinds of things. Like, my dad really liked Impressionists, so we saw like every Impressionist gallery in London, and I hated them. But I finally said, oh, there's a signing event. Peter Davidson, the new Doctor, is going to be there. And so we got there late. Everybody was outside, and I was buying a book for him to sign, and he came rushing through to go upstairs and get changed, and I got kind of knocked over by him. And then I was like, oh my God, that's Peter Davidson.
So did you not get the book signed in there?
I did. I went out and I stood in line and got the book signed. Mind you, they didn't have any of the novels of the Peter Davidson era, so I had to have him sign one from the Tom Baker era. So
I wanna start with, you know, the blog. Uh-huh. I'm a big fan of your prolific blogging. You know, it is a kind of endless source of expertise and enthusiasm for the hobby. That's a big thing for me, which is this idea of like, what are the spaces where if I'm interested in games, I can keep going back to, and there's something kind of there that, you know, helps me, gets me excited and things like that. So I know the blog started in 2009, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
I scrolled all the way to the bottom. And
early stuff is terrible, too. The first 3 years are garbage, so.
I think the first year, you were trying to write every day, and I think you have about 283 posts in that year. What was the impetus to start? Did you know what the blog was, and what is it now?
Well, it came out of, I had been working at a university press and had been there for a long time. And there had been some things with like getting locked down into my position and not being able to move up and so on. And I had some other opportunities. And so I left that just as the financial crisis hit and all the opportunities dried up. So I spent the next years or so like trying to get interviews and so on. And eventually I started the blog as a way to like have a daily focus and have, you know, do writing and, you know, just get words down on page so that I was keeping active in that. And you can tell from those first couple of years that it is very much me pushing myself to just kind of say things. And there came a point where I kind of let go of that and really started to think about what it was I wanted to be doing, what it was I wanted to be talking about, what ideas were interesting to me. For a while, when RPG Geek first started to have blogs, I would do a list over there on their site, and I would write a blog in there, and then I would also write a kind of additional blog on my site. And that was a lot of work. But eventually I got into more of a rhythm, settling down, trying not to do more than two posts a week. And eventually more weekly, where I can do that. And especially now, in the last 4 years or so, with the pandemic and everything, like, that has really messed with my ability to focus. And I'm happy if I can get a blog post out each week, quite honestly. So it's been a good focus thing.
It's interesting that you mention focus and writing and things like that, because even though you're now saying, those early days were terrible, do you still stand by that advice? Because I know what I'm doing with the newsletter is also kind of like, let's just write something every week. And that process does kind of work out. So is that something you would still recommend? Is that something you would stand by, like, for somebody else?
I think setting yourself a goal, but a reasonable goal, and saying to yourself, I'm going to do, 1,000 to 2,000 words each week on a blog post. Like, that's, and I think that's a reasonable number. Set yourself a kind of a word count. Because sometimes you'll get to writing and you'll overwrite and you realize that you're 4,000 words in and you really should have split this up into a couple of things. But yeah, I think it's good practice. It's good practice for writing in general, just to be doing that. Any kind of writing is a good mental exercise, and it's good practice for doing other kinds of writing.
This is a pattern I have seen, like, when I kind of look through your blog as well, because you're talking about pacing yourself now. And I think this sort of reflective, like, view, looking back on this, 10 plus year process, because in 2009, 2010, you do this thing where you're like, in October, I'm going to review 30 games in this month and things like that, which is really cool, but also, I imagine, unsustainable.
It was. Some of that was also that there are times I signed up for other things to kind of push myself. There was a reviewer contest on RPG Geek that was the Iron Reviewer that essentially started with a big bunch of people, and the time period to turn in the next review got shorter and shorter until there were two of us posting daily or twice a day, and the other person finally said uncle. Reviews are interesting. Like, I look back at my early reviews and there are some things I appreciate in them where I am trying to talk to people about, like, what does this look like at the table? How useful is this book? Can you bring it into other things? But then there's also that problem with reviews where a lot of it is summary. Here's what's in the book. Here's what this chapter, so on. Yeah. And it always kind of frustrates me when I go back and I look at one of my reviews and there's more restatement of what's in the book than there is analysis and providing people with, ideas and suggestions about, like, how to use that material.
Is this because when you're writing a review, and this is more of a problem with games than I think with other media, is that when you're writing a review, you're writing for somebody who hasn't read or played the game, mm-hmm. right?
One of the interesting things is I think there's a real difference between reviewing the core book for something where, I assume that people, maybe don't know it. I'm going to need to explain the rules a little bit to give them a sense of what resolution has looked like, to give them a sense of what the complexity is. Like, I think that's really important, is to get across to people, these are the steps that are happening in resolution. This is how long it takes to resolve something. This is what's going on there. So that they know what that mechanical density is, because that's a real judgment point, I think, for a lot of people. But a lot more interesting are trying to figure out how to review the splat books and the source books and things like that. And I know you've been looking at the city books on your blog, and that's really interesting to me, is, like, going to the source books for a game and deciding, okay, who is this for? How useful is it? What would people want if this, like if they were going for this book, what would they want out of it? And does this book deliver that? I think that's the more interesting set of reviews, because I think adventures get reviewed and core books get reviewed, but these kind of secondary source books often get overlooked, and sometimes because they fall into the same pattern over and over again, like old World of Darkness splat books, it's very much the same thing over and over again.
Even in your answer now, there's this kind of, you have this sort of cataloging sensibility, right? You mentioned RPG Geek. I know that you're a major contributor there in the sense of RPG Geek's catalog. Do you know how much you've contributed to that site over the years?
I was for a very long time. Once RPG Geek got up, I was by miles, the most prolific data entry person. And then there was somebody else who worked a night shift and pass me up. But there's still a lot of the entries that I put in there, some obscure corners that we didn't have covered. You know, if I saw a line that I knew, I would put that in. And it was a lot of work to get the data because you needed to put in, you know, all the credits and you need to come up with some definitional things. And I would say that work probably is what made it so that I felt comfortable enough to do those history of RPG genre lists, because I had such a breadth of looking at games and the history of games and looking through that catalog and seeing the tools that were on RPG Geek and other sites like Le Grog, which is a French site. They cover a lot of the French games and other European games and things like that. So yeah, that kind of led me to doing those things.
I think we should talk about those RPG histories because they strike me as unique achievements of yours in this space. For people who aren't aware, if you go to the Age of Ravens blog right now, you will find these exhaustive histories that Lowell has written, multi-part histories, usually by genre. So, you know, you might see a history of RPGs in cyberpunk, a history of post-apocalyptic games, and these are chronological. Mm-hmm. So Lowell might start with the earliest one that he's found and then kind of like move forward. First of all, what is the pleasure of doing that? Why do you keep going back?
So one of the things is that it's a clear task. And I'll admit that, like when you're blogging, a lot of the times you're like, oh, what am I going to come up with? And if you can come up with an idea for a series that works and do it, and it becomes a real pleasure to run that through. And so doing those histories, I have a structure, I have a format. It gives me a chance to go back and uncover and look up for resources on these different things. So there's a real pleasure that I would say. And I have enough of an academic background that I sometimes cringe that I call them a history, because while I'm commenting on these pieces, you know, on these games, I'm giving some details, I'm giving some impressions, things like that. But there's a whole layer of historical analysis that I hope to God somebody comes along and does at some point, because there's somebody needs to be doing an analysis on, you know, what system means to setting in these genres, the evolution of certain things, like the idea of spending points to change things like fortune points or fate points, things like that. And even thematics, like I submitted a talk for Metatopia when they were going to do their online thing. They didn't do that, but I was going to look at all of the post-apocalyptic games and go, what are the trends? What are the kinds of apocalypses? How do those change over time? Those kinds of things. I think I'm doing very much a, like, I don't know if you call it lexicographic or just encyclopedist approach to putting these things out there. There's a lot of impressions. I'm hoping that in the next 10, 20 years, we'll see some people really doing histories of RPGs that aren't histories of D&D or just the early days or things like that. Like, I appreciate that Bill White did that book that's the history of the Forge, and it's a really good book. It's very academic, but it's a really interesting read. There's another book from Palgrave on Japanese RPG that is very, very academic. Like, way past my pay grade for semiotic theory and so on, and communication theory. But yeah, I enjoyed doing them because I love games and because they were an easy task.
I really hope we get to see that seminar that you were planning to do about this. I look at your histories of post-apocalyptic games, and there are 22 parts. So can we just get a taste of that? Why are there so many post-apocalyptic games? Should I stop making mine? Because is this a satiated space?
One of the things that's interesting is that there are two axes of post-apocalypse games. One is kind of, what kind of apocalypse is it? Like, you know, is it a zombie apocalypse? Is it nuclear? Is it biological? Is it climate? Is it ecological? And I think certain things rise and decline as tensions. The nuclear stuff goes out of fashion after a while, but other things start to rise up as considerations. And even then, in more recent times, games that just say, there was an apocalypse, we don't know, you tell us, you know, like Apocalypse World. And I think that apocalypse TTRPGs are like a year or two behind other media. So I think if you look at big hit apocalyptic literature in movies and things like that, you can see those happen. And then I think you can look 2 or 3 years down the road and you'll start to see people maybe using, if it's a new interesting theme, where that comes out. Like 28 Days Later really kicked the zombie genre up. And I know that All Flesh Must Be Eaten was around that time, and we see the change in the rise of the zombie genre. But the other axis that's really interesting for post-apocalyptic is where we are in relation to the apocalypse. Are we right now in the middle of it? Like, is that happening? And maybe the game's about trying to stop it. Are we in the immediate aftermath? Are we a generation or two down the road? Are we, you know, 100 or 200 years down the road, which is a very different game? Or are we, like, we're in a world that's fallen and we can't even remember why it fell? And I think that there's a shift to those games.
What is a game that has, like, a very strong premise of what the apocalypse was and that kind of engages with that?
Oh, that's a really good question. Wireless soul transmission is a really interesting game. It's a sort of future cyber world, and everybody is networked to this augmented reality world, and something terribly goes wrong and it shatters that, and there's this kind of infection that is happening in that virtual world, and people are cut off from it and they're having problems with it. It's really interesting. Like, it's got a very strong premise and, like, very little I've seen elsewhere. It's a really unique setup. Kid World is another one. That's an early one from the designer of Amp Year One, whose name escapes me right now. But that's one where all the adults have kind of gone blind and mad, and the kids haven't, and the kids have to survive. And it's the earliest of those kids in an apocalyptic world games that came out, because there's a French one, of course, that came out a few years after that, and there's at least 2 or 3 others.
I like games with a strong premise. If a game has a strong premise, it kind of tells you what it's about in some sense. You know, you can just read it and know. Mm-hmm. But something like Apocalypse World, which leaves it open, and maybe this is a trend with more recent games, is that because deciding what the apocalypse was is one of the things the game wants you to do, because that's sort of what it's about.
Yeah, I often feel that there's a difference between sort of premise, which can involve, okay, what we're doing in the play, what the sort of inciting incident is, or what the vibe is, versus setting. And often that's where I'll read a game that I think has a really cool premise, like it has a really, really interesting idea, has a really interesting pitch. I dig it. But then when I go to the book, it's all very specific setting. Doesn't give me imaginative space to play around with that. And I think that more games in recent years have had a strong premise, but also recognized to give us, you know, space to build that world with that premise, with that concept.
This is a good point for us to kind of segue into GMing a little bit.
Sure.
Because I think what you're talking about is sort of this, you know, phenomenon with trad games and trad publishing, where there was a lot of setting material and it was kind of given to you. And in some games, you could read them and then be confused about what you actually do in this place, right? Like, what do I do here? What is interesting for me is that you run a lot of trad games and you run a lot of story games. I don't know if these words are meaningful to you or you want to use them as well, but do you approach these kinds of games differently? Does that kind of divide make sense to you in terms of a GM, like when you get a new game, how you approach it?
Yeah. You know, there are two kinds of trad. I'm not talking OSR. OSR is a whole different beast. But let's say trad. Trad is usually a game that has a lot of mechanical complexity in that there are a lot of decision moments made for any particular role. Choices on the place of the part of the player, choices on the place of the GM that have to be made. And then the role, like, doesn't have a big effect. Like, I really like 2D20 from Modiphius, but a couple of versions of it, Conan and Star Trek, there are a lot of steps and procedure to go through to make a particular role. And often the end result is, you know, I do X damage to an opponent.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, that was a lot of effing work. I should either take the person out or something else should change in the world. That's a certain kind of trad of a lot of detail. D&D has a lot of detail because the players have a lot of choices and there's a lot of information, a lot of potential modifiers and those kinds of things, even though the basic resolution at the core of rolling a D20 is pretty simple. But then there's also games that are trad in that they have a lot of setting and the setting kind of matters. And you kind of have to know it to get, like, Shadowrun. Like, if I were going to go run Shadowrun, I would really have to read about Shadowrun. I don't think I could fake it and have it feel that way. There are a lot of games where I can fake it. I generally try to run when I do trad adjacent games, Trindy or Tradindle or, you know, that overlap. I try to find games where I can read the setting, I can have a sense of it, and I know I can fake it at the table. I can give players the flavor of it, but I don't know, have to know everything about it. And there are some games that work well that way and some that don't.
I realize I might have kind of misframed trad games there, because, I mean, some of them with those deep settings, but it is also just this kind of style of play.
I've been all over the spectrum, but my tastes have changed. What I want from the game has changed. To reference back to what we said before, like, I sometimes go back to those early posts on my blog where I go, this is what I want from combat, or this is what I want from this. Yeah. And I go, that's not what I want anymore. That's not at all what I want. These are things that had value to me then that no longer have value to me as a player or a GM.
I mean, you have to tell us what you value now. Like, just give us a sense of how your tastes have changed.
I want any particular action that we do to have weight to it, not knocking a few hit points off. I want the ability that we can take an action and it has significant weight and it can move the focus forward. I want to have any particular conflict especially if I'm running online, to take no more than 30 minutes. That's kind of my hard limit. And that's from, okay, we've got the map set up, to the end of the fight. Like, that's my sweet spot. I also want it to be easy for characters to help one another.
Yeah.
To do an assist or an aid or something, to encourage that, rather than, okay, well, you can help them, but that's going to cost your action and it's not going to do that much.
Yeah.
Which just always feels like a little limiting to me, because I want people to be thinking of clever stuff and supporting one another at the table. You know, one of the things that has been, and this is kind of related but slightly tangential, one of the things that has been spoiling for running PBTA games is that any particular role, you know, gives me a framework for what's going to happen. Like, gives me a framework to go, okay, this is a success. If it's a success, well, I'm going to tell the player how amazing a success it is and it can be great. Or it's a failure, and I'm going to look at how I make that failure interesting, and the GM has some hard moves that I can pull in, and it becomes meaningful. I can easily go, well, you succeed, but here's this horrible thing that happens as well. And then there's success with cost. Like, that easy three-part structure, when it is absent from a game, I really feel it these days, because I do have to go, okay, what does failure look like here? Is the game supporting the idea of fail forward or fail with consequence? I think that PBTA is just easy, at least for where my mind is wired at this point.
Is this why you kind of started designing with PBTA? Because apart from Hearts of Wulin, which is, I think, a really kind of inventive PBTA game that not enough people talk about or play. But I know you're also designing, you have these hacks. I think for a long time, you've had this Changeling the Lost hack in PBTA, which I can hear like whispers about of people who played those games and go like, wow, it's amazing. I know it's credited in Ray Najjardi's Apocalypse Keys as an influence. And this is a game that I think people can't find. I mean, for legal reasons, I assume also, like, you can't just kind of put it out there.
There is a link to a character keeper that has all the materials. I have that because, and I'm not making profit. It's just out there. It's a thing people can look at and reuse as they will. You know, I first started playing PBTA because that was what Rich Rogers talked about all the time. And I was hanging around with Rich and I was playing with Rich and I didn't get it. And I wrote some hacks for it, kind of just not getting it. And once I got it, once I got what was happening with it, I was like, wow, this answers a lot of my needs as a GM. It's doing what I want in terms of having permission to move things forward, in terms of having permission to go, now I'm going to hit you hard. You know that's going to happen. We're all on the same page on this. And letting the dice really run things and having that in front of the players. Like, I'm not making rolls behind the screen or anything like that. There's that kind of being out in the open, which I really love.
Yeah, I think it's hard for someone like me, because I started playing only after PBTA, it's hard for me to kind of gauge that moment where this becomes a style of play or a design movement, a kind of ethos, and then it kind of changes everything after that.
I had an earlier version of Hearts of Wulin that I put together that was very much, much more inspired by, say, Dungeon World and Monster of the Week's Crunch and all of the other things. And it had all of this stuff. And I kept wrestling with it because you have all that detail, that then that requires more work, more coming up with things. And I just got frustrated with it. And once I kind of let go of all of that and went, okay, we're just going to have scale. That's all that matters. Do you win a fight? Are they better than you? Are they on your level as a challenge? Are they worse than you? Like, once that opened up and I was able to let go of so much other stuff and go, this is all that matters. This is what we want to play with. We want to have entanglements and we want to have a cool fight. That's the thing.
That is so interesting because it's surprising how often what we appreciate from a game is what it's cut out.
Yeah, and some of the feedback I got during the playtesting process was, you know, I want this, I want that. And I had to say, that's not what this game is. That's not what this game is about. There are a lot of games out there, Tian Sha, Weapons of the Gods, the Ospreys Ulin game, that are doing really interesting stuff with having lots of maneuvers and having players like be better than one another in certain regards and those kinds of things. Yeah. And that's great. Like, if that's what you want, but that's not what I wanted. I wanted heartbreak and drama because that's what I was seeing in those Wuxia TV shows.
The thing that you hear about when people kind of talk about Hearts of Wulin is that inner conflict move. Like, people love that move. And for people who haven't played, it's a move that says that when you come face to face with emotional turmoil or pressure from kind of a personal relationship or issue, you mark XP and you roll, and the move just decides whether you can keep it together or whether you run away because things have gotten too intense. Why do people love that move so much?
I think because in some ways, I wait and I watch and I see when somebody stops and I see the player go, oh God, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, okay, that rises the level in a conflict. And that gives them a chance to make a roll and move some of the responsibility onto the dice. But even in that process of making that roll and dice, you see people realize what they actually want. Like, because they go, I hope it doesn't do this. I hope this isn't what happens. And, you know, sometimes when they fail, I'll ask them, what is it the thing you want to have happen? And they'll tell me, and okay, well, that's not what happens. I like pacing and flow, and so I like keeping things moving. But inner conflict is a great point to, like, pause, let the player reassess, and then we get a really interesting character moment out of it. One of the things that's most important to me is, a lot of times it's obvious when inner conflict is going to happen because, as I said, people are themselves are struggling, or, you know, it's really clear from the table dynamic. But sometimes it kind of washes up, and I like to say to them, do you think this rises to the level of inner conflict? And let them choose, like, how severe this moment is for them. And sometimes they say, yeah, I really think it does. And sometimes they say, no, I think I know what I want. I think I have control of this. It isn't quite there yet. And that's what I love. You know, it's a move with a loose trigger, which I know some PPTA people don't like. But I do think that for me, the triggers need to be a little looser and have a little bit of flexibility. And that one especially, like, it's a bonding moment of the GM and player.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And it makes a lot of sense because this is a strange move in the sense that it is a move about something not happening to some extent. Like, you know, it isn't, hey, GM, I want to do X. I want to trigger this move so that I can achieve that. This is, and these reactive moves, people often don't like them because mm-hmm. they're like, I have to remember to trigger the move. But in this particular thing, players kind of squirm with enjoyment because they're like, oh, yes, I get to trigger the reactive move that I've been waiting to trigger because that's what this game is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I generally agree on the reactive moves, especially for playbook moves. Reactive playbook moves are often a real challenge, but I think having that out there as one of the basic moves and having kind of a different dynamic to it works.
Yeah, you know, it definitely does. I think the consensus is quite clear. Okay, so I have an eye on time. So
sure.
There's just some stuff that I want to cover. So I'm going to awkwardly segue us into talking about community management.
Sure.
So a general question, I'd like you to just kind of tell us how long you've been a community manager, what kind of responsibilities that involves.
So I have been the community manager since July of 2019 for the Gauntlet gaming community. Prior to that, for I would say a year, 2 years, I was a person who kind of oversaw onboarding GMs and talking with people about play and trying to work with GMs and things. Being a community manager is a really tough and kind of, you know, I don't want to say a thankless task, but it's a challenging task. You keep the calendar running, you keep the discussion running, but you also need to be moderating. You need to be talking with a team of people about decisions that are made. You need to be going, if there are big changes to be made, you need to go and talk to them. You need to be thinking about where we go down the line, what kind of events we want to support, what kind of things we want to do, you know, those important choices. And you're also sort of where the buck stops when there are problems. You know, we've had to ban some people from the community over time. Some of those processes have been easy. Some of those processes have been tough. And I think I stand by every one of them. And I stand by the process that we have a solid code of conduct that we have developed and refined with community backing. That's for things like harassment, you know, violation of safety, those kinds of like what I would call high level issues. I think more challenging are questions of good play and trying to make sure that you keep a culture that respects safety, that follows a process in doing that, and encourages people, if they do have problems with other players, to come and say, hey, this person kind of consistently has been talking over me, or this person, you know, spoke to me in this way, or so on, and then taking action and following up on that, you know. And I've intervened multiple times talking with people. One of the things we've done is sometimes a GM says, I can't play with this player anymore. And so I have to go to the player and say, we have an open door for players that they can step away from a game. In the same way, we respect the safety of GMs. If certain players clash with their values or their approach, it is fine to say, you know, don't want to have this player in my game. And it's one of the things that I want to do in 2023. There are a couple of things. I'm going to ramble on here. I apologize. One of those is I want to see if I can get together other people who are running RPG communities, the community managers from Discords or groups or forums, whatever, and see if we can get together to talk about process, to talk about, okay, how are you handling things? What are you doing? You know, what are your procedures? Because I don't think there's that communication of those things at all. I haven't seen any discussion. And I think we need to be talking about that, because TTGRP spaces are very unique, distinct kinds of environments that have certain requirements, and managing those in a healthy way is a challenge. The other thing I want to do this year is we have a community code of conduct that we created at the beginning of 2020. It's based on existing code of conduct from an open source code, and we adjusted it, and we brought it to the community, and the community edited it and built it. And I think it's pretty good. But I want to sit down with a group of POC women, you know, specifically trans people, to look over that, to see whether that code is helping them, like is providing that safe environment. You know, are there things we could be doing better to involve them? Because I'm just terrified that maybe we're not doing well by them, and that they've been shortchanged by other communities, and they think, okay, it's just like my other experiences. There's nothing I can do. I don't want to say anything. I'll just quit. I'll stop playing, whatever. I know that there are going to be those invisible things that we can't see, but I want to see, like, I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to get that more visible. You know, here's the thing. This all goes with community manager things. I'm a dinosaur. I am 53 years old, white male. I come from a very different original environment. I have gotten better as I've gotten older, I think, even as I've seen my peers get worse. But I know I'm a dinosaur, and I think if there's any legacy I want, if there's anything I want the community to do, you know, once I step away, is that we have made better space for marginalized gamers we've done something to open that up and to support them. And that's what I want. I want to play my elf games, and I want to have our community and its processes, you know, give opportunities and provide safe spaces for players who might not otherwise feel safe.
You know, first of all, thank you for that answer. I really appreciate the thoughts behind it. And this might be kind of like, you know, trite response. But I will say that as a member of that space, I really appreciate it. And I have kind of found something that was hard for me to access elsewhere. And I think a part of it is once you find a space, it doesn't have to be the space you're in forever. Like, but it does kind of give you this thing to go and maybe make your own spaces after exactly. that and things like that. Yeah.
I would love it if people came, played with us for a while, saw our community tools, saw our processes, and as several have, go and build their own communities. That's great. It's a churn. You know, I have people that I love that don't play with us anymore because they're playing with other groups, and I miss them, but I'm glad they're out there playing and maybe bringing in other people into the hobby.
So these are some questions that I want to sort of ask everybody who comes on the show and then kind of build this repetition and just see what comes out of it. First question, I've got it titled Infectious Enthusiasm. And okay. I want to ask you, what's a game that you've had a lot of fun with and that you just want to recommend to listeners?
So my answer is going to be a little odd, but it's because this game hit me in a really interesting way. In the middle of reading all these cyberpunk games for kind of doing this history of recent games, I picked up a game that I didn't think I was going to like, that I would say looks a little more trad than other games. And when I started reading it, the presentation of information and the way it helps the player and the GM get through things is amazing. Eclipse Phase 2nd Edition. I never thought it was it because the transhumanist games like never seemed like a thing for me. It is so well written. The way it presents stuff, how it's got things set up, the way it introduces the setting, the way it gives you sample characters and talks about the different, it's really well done. And I'm kind of stunned at how good a job it does in presenting rules material and setting at the same time. I would never have expected that. It's a game I've read. And I'm like, this might not be my cup of tea, but I definitely have to run this in 2023 just because the book is so good.
Sold. I want to play Eclipse Phase 2nd Edition as well now. So the second thing, I'm titling this Tyranny of Numbers. And I want a statistic or a kind of numerical breakdown of some aspect of your process that you think people who are just getting into the hobby right now might go like, okay, that's a concrete piece of information.
Yeah, I'll give you a time crunch thing here. When I go to prepare a new game to run, there is a process I go through, reading the book, looking at that, creating the character keeper, because that's a way to teach rules. And maybe there's a rules cheat sheet. Like I'd had to do that with Swords of the Serpentine recently, which I know you're running. But that was a real process to get that under my belt. To digest that, that's anywhere from 5 to 10 hours, let's say. There's probably another hour, like maybe thinking about what the pitch is going to be and writing up the event descriptions. And then before that first session, there's probably, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours going, okay, what are we actually going to do at the table? Do I need to have a mystery ready? Do I need to have a scenario ready? Boom, boom. And then after that, on any given session, I do not prepare more than an hour. And in fact, I do this very, very deliberately. I do not, if my game is at 8, I do not go up into the computer until 7 o'clock. And even then, I probably goof around. I look over my notes. I do that. That is the way I keep sane because I run 4 or 5 games a week and it's doable. Now, mind you, some games are prep heavy and I kind of enjoy that. I ran Delta Green earlier this year and that was a game where it was an exercise in reading and doing a lot more prep. But even there, I kept it tight. Like once I'd kind of gotten the outline of a mystery, boom, no more than an hour before the session. I think if you're feeling overwhelmed, let go of some things. There's a phrase in miniature painting that is, don't paint what you can't see. I try not to work on ideas or materials that we aren't going to get at the table. We're not going to get a chance to see at the table. You know, I'm always thinking about the games. I mean, that's always in the background. That's the background home of my life. But in terms of like really doing hard hands-on work, I try to keep it tight. If you're feeling overwhelmed with your prep and so on, let go a little and see how it goes.
That's really interesting because you said you start with about 5 to 10 hours potentially. Just if this is a new game to you, you kind of have to start from scratch. Like you turn the page, you know, page one, and you're going from there.
Absolutely.
Is there a sense of like what kind of games you go into going like, okay, if I'm going to spend 5 to 10 hours on this, do you think about how long you're going to play it? Does that factor in?
Yeah. You know, sometimes if I know I'm going to be doing a quarterly, I will extend out what I'm doing more broadly in that I'm not actually reading rules or doing character, but I'm reading in the genre. When I ran Knights Black Agents, I went and listened to a lot of spy podcasts, and I went back and read my favorite La Carré novels, and that's all kind of fuel for the mill. In the quarter one of 2023, I'm going to run Fearful Symmetries, which is the Trail of Cthulhu sort of magic in Britain in 1930s. And a lot of it's based on Blake. So I've been reading about Blake and I've been watching stuff like Agatha Christie stuff and things that are kind of set in that period. I have a book on grimoires I've been reading, but I've been reading a lot about interwar Britain. And that's all kind of, you know, it's fun. It's sort of prep, but it's sort of not prep. It's sort of just getting me in the headspace. So that's the other kind of thing I will do if I know it's going to be a long game. But I also like a long game where I know I don't have to do that. Like I'm going to run Mountain Home, which is that Forge in the Dark dwarven game. I'm not going to do a bunch of extra prep for that. You know, it's Forge in the Dark. A lot of that we built at the table. I'll come in each session, look at what we've got and come up with some cool ideas, and it will be great.
It's interesting that you like both of those things and you can kind of talk about how they're kind of pleasurable in their own ways. I know there is, you know, some sense on the internet that you can only like one kind of thing. And definitely have to back up your idea of just sometimes consuming some kind of similar media is the funnest way to prep. Like I know watching Andor has been so good for my Songs for the Dusk game, just because I'm looking at this and I'm going like, wow, I like what I'm seeing. And then it just works its way into my game. I'm not doing it consciously. There's just a moment in the game. I'm like, this happens. And I know why I said that. It's because I saw it on TV.
Prep by osmosis and steal ruthlessly.
Okay. So yeah, third section, sort of I'm titling this replay. What's a story or anecdote you've heard about someone else playing one of your games?
Well, it's just kind of one of the things I've seen with Hearts of Wulin over the time that it's been out that I really like, and it's not like a very specific anecdote, but it's kind of general, is seeing people hacking it and using it for other things. Like when it was still in playtest, I saw somebody post about having used it to do John Woo. And I love that. And we've seen it used to do a Cobra Kai game on the Gauntlet, and Jim Crocker used it to do a Scott Pilgrim game, and some people have done Cyberpunk and some other things. And that, I love that. That's what I want people to do. I know that the game has a really useful engine, and seeing people take that and applying it and figuring out their own things and not coming to me for approval, not coming to me for advice, just doing it. Like, that's what I want, you know, giving people a tool set to let their imagination run free.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad that we stuck to time.
And yeah.
Even though there were moments that I was like, I want to ask a follow-up question. And I guess, you know, maybe I need to kind of narrow the scope of these conversations a little bit just so that we can linger. But, you know, this doesn't have to be the last time we speak.
Oh, no. So. this is the only the second time I've been asked on a podcast. So this is a real honor for me. I really love that because I like talking about this stuff. I have enjoyed playing with you and talking with you in the past. So it's really fun.
Lowell, if people want to find you on the internet, is there some links you want to kind of throw out here?
So if you want to email me, if people have questions, at edige23@gmail.com. While Twitter still stands, even though it's a reprehensible cesspool and getting worse and worse, I'm at EDIGE23 on there. And of course, Age of Ravens Games, all one word, is the new blog, which has links to all the videos and the history lists and the blog itself. There's an RSS feed for the blog, so people can check that out.